Our second speaker is Judith Stubbs, and Judith conducts research and publishes on a wide range of issues, including urban social justice, affordable housing, aged accommodation and services planning, social and economic impact assessment of gaming and various types of urban developments, labour market studies and the regional economic development. And today Dr Judith Stubbs is going to talk to us about the impacts of policy on community wellbeing in the Murray-Darling Basin. So welcome, Judith.
Thanks very much for having me today. Today I'm going to talk about a project I've been doing for about the last 10 months, funded by the Cotton Catchment Communities CRC. And I'm currently in the third stage of the study, so I'm going to be reporting preliminary findings, or findings on the first two stages, and then the preliminaries on the third stage. And I've just come off the road after 7 weeks up in the northern basin and then down through the southern basin in eight of the case study communities that we're looking at in depth around changes and potential changes in water policy, including the forthcoming basin plan. And it's been a very humbling experience talking to communities, and I see some people around the table today, so it's great to see you, and thanks for your help. It's been amazing, and I've learned an enormous amount. So I shall talk about first aims of the study. We're looking at, and we've identified, I think, some time ago, the fact that the Water Act 2007, whilst a very important initiative, does privilege the environment. And a lot of the work that was being done on environmental impacts were probably not, until quite recently, matched by other work on social and economic impacts at the basin level nor in communities. And so some time ago I started talking with the CRC about the possibility of doing that kind of work, which we're trying to get in and will be getting out in advance of the basin plan. So I'll talk a bit more about that later. The aim of the study is to predict the social and economic impacts of changes in agricultural production, including cotton, on community wellbeing resilience at different scales, and particularly related to most recent federal policy and pending climate change, and also to actually inform the development of responses and mitigations, particularly talking with communities about what they should be. So there's a lot of field work as well as desktop work that's been involved in the study that we're doing. It was very useful hearing Professor Martin talk about this. There's three useful and somewhat interrelated concepts. As you'll see, the first paper that's out is a scoping paper where we define these concepts and talk about their theoretical basis. So I'm not going to burden you with that today. But community wellbeing, resilience and sustainability. Wellbeing, you know, I guess when I bring together all the literature and think about my experiences, it tends to be a place where people experience a positive life satisfaction, an adequate standard of living relevant for that society, and opportunities to participate in the life of the community. It's got some dimensions that you can measure by indicators that we've done at a desktop level and others have done too, but also very important experiential aspects of that. So community resilience, we talked about this before and I thought it was some very useful work that was being talked again about again by Professor Martin. The ability of a community to positively and flexibly adapt to short and long-term stressors in the external or the internal environment within a reasonable time and with minimal disruption so they can maintain this adequate standard of community wellbeing. So that idea of really resilience about, you know, a community often won't look the same after it's responded to change, but hopefully it will keep going and there will be as little disruption as possible and moving to maybe a different stage or state, and that's healthy. Community sustainability, and again, it's drawing together a range of different work. For me, it's a community that adapts to change by optimising social, economic and environmental outcomes to maximise the wellbeing of all its members now and in the future. And community engagement, as Professor Martin, is extremely important in that, including with members with diverse needs and values and aspirations. And often there'll be distributional impacts, obviously, or distributional aspects to that, and one group might have to be privileged over another when they're particularly disadvantaged in the community. And when I think about this, in terms of the framework for the way we look at things, there are obviously that external ring of circles. Lots of things have an impact on community wellbeing and resilience and those indicators, if you like, that we've looked at in the inner circle, the social things, the economic and the environmental factors. things like technological change are having massive impacts and have for a long time. International and national outputs, like fluctuations in commodities prices. The attributes of a local area or community are vital, you know, how, what the leadership is like, how cohesive it is, those types of things. Short and long-term climatic variation, very relevant, so the, one of the areas we're particularly obviously singling out for attention in this study, and national, state and local government policy, and again an area that intersects at this time with the availability of water, so those two kind of circles down in that that lower quarter are important. And if you change one of those things, or a number of those things, obviously things in those inner circles change, things like employment, population, those types of things. As we've heard, technological change has massive changes in terms of employment, particularly in certain industries in the past. So we're trying to vary, which is pretty hard. We're trying to vary and look at those two, particularly policy and its impact on water, and then its impact on indicators. So I'm going to really zip through this because I want to get to the kind of end, because there's a lot of quantitative stuff here, but I really want to give a flavour for the qualitative work that's going to be in this this last report, which is about the experiences of communities in the context of massive changes affecting them now and potentially in the future with changes under the Basin Plan. So the first research strategy was looking at agricultural production, that is land devoted to a range of agricultural uses, and then the impact on employment and both direct and indirect employment. And that's the foundation to look at employment, if you like, as a common currency in the work we're doing, particularly in the cost-benefit analysis stage at the last part. So I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. The second research strategy, which we've also finished, which is moving further onto that, looking at climate and policy change, which will reduce, very likely reduce, water allocations or entitlement in the future, potentially permanently. Then we've looked at then the change in agricultural use you could expect to find, the change in employment you could expect to find at different geographic scales, and then the impact via a linear regression analysis, which I won't burden you with the graphs and various things that were in a report, on community wellbeing and resilience, those inner circles of those indicators. So we've done a fairly big desktop analysis around those particular indicators and how they might change as water changes and agricultural mix changes. So what we're trying to do is forecast in advance of the Basin Plan what might happen as a result of those kinds of changes that we're all anticipating at this stage. The third thing that I'm doing at the moment, which is where I've just come back out of the field to get a lot of desktop analysis. The inputs from those first two are being used in a cost-benefit analysis, and then reality testing and looking at the distribution impacts via interviews and engagement with eight communities. And there's been an enormous response. It's been quite extraordinary, the kind of way that people have opened their homes and councils have convened full council meetings. There's an enormous amount of concern in the Southern Basin and in the Northern Basin, particularly around making sure these impacts are heard. So we've had an amazing time and lots of access to people and communities and so on. So we're looking at different scales on community wellbeing and resilience, the farm, the community, or the local, the regional, the basin and the national level, and those impacts are very differently distributed depending on where you live and at what scale you look at them. So what might be really good for the nation might be devastating for a small community, and they're the kind of trade-offs and the difficulties that obviously frame federal government policy development. And then we're then refining that. We're going back into the field next week for another series of visits throughout the basin where the councils are convening workshops and we're assisting with those. And then the development of locally appropriate strategies to mitigate these adverse impacts. So we're really asking them, well, what is it that you need? You know, and many of the things that they need are probably not going to be within their reach. So, first one, agricultural production and employment mix. I'm just focusing a little bit on the Northern Basin, and then I will be spending some time on the South too. Agriculture accounts for about a third of employment in cotton growing statistical local areas in the basin, at least 2,300 employed in cotton growing and related activities, at least 4,600, 5,000 if you include a multiplier of 1.1 for the agricultural average, and we've derived that from the census, but the cotton multiplier we know is likely to be higher because of the irrigation industry, the earth moving plant, all those kind of flow-ons. It's likely to have a higher multiplier than is actually accounted for. So all of these are underestimates, which we say very, very clearly. In terms of first that baseline information, you know, in terms of knowing what the mix of agriculture contributes to employment, If you're looking at it, we looked at it two different ways. Again, from the 2005-06 growing season, that's the most recent comprehensive analysis available, but also it aligns neatly with the 2006 census and all those indicators from that, plus major health studies and so on we are drawn on as well, and crime studies. So cotton per 1,000 hectares, about 7 people. Dryland cropping, about 1.2, grazing a lot less. Rice, about 16. Grapes, interestingly, about 97 people per hectare, 1,000 hectares. Fruit, 74. Vegetables, large. Irrigated dairy, about 15. So you can see where the employment is actually concentrated, and that's the full-time equivalence, and it is just the direct on-farm and related, for example, Virginia and so on-farm employment. When we look at the water use, and again, you know, it took us a long time to put together this data set, and working from every available piece of data we had. Cotton, 1.2 people, equivalent to rice, about 1.3 per gigalitre. Cropping and grazing, next best uses in most of these areas, much lower. But when you go down to your grapes, about 17, or grapes, veggies, fruit, about 15, 16, 17 per gigalitre. Much more intensive uses, a lot more labour in them, as you know. In some cases, a lot less ability to modernise and to implement higher technologies because of picking requirements. Irrigated grazing, 4 to 5 people. So you can see there are significant differences in terms of water use, and you can see that if you were to obtain water from some areas, then there would be massive job losses and job losses throughout. So if there was a major reduction in water availability, such that cotton, for example, was replaced by the next best use, if it was replaced by dryland cropping, up to 6,000 jobs in the cotton growing areas of the Murray-Darling Basin, by dryland grazing, 7,000 jobs, that's an underestimate. So that's not taking into account multipliers. That's simply direct employment if there was a significant reduction in water availability, and I'll go on to that in specific towns in a minute. There are major differences in terms of the distribution of the impact in terms of the size of town and reliance on agriculture. So our scaling indicates that there are critical scales around 5,000, 10,000 and 50,000 people, but certainly areas with less than 5,000 people, there's only 1 9A job for about 29 residents, and areas of 10,000, about 1 to 9. So that's strongly influenced, that top figure, by your areas that have got 600, 2,000 people. So you can see that these areas that have got smaller populations and higher reliance on agriculture are extremely vulnerable to changes in water allocation. So if water was allocated to other uses, for example, by a permanent out-of-area trade like the buyback, or the setting of different sustainable diversion limits under the basin plan, there might be, depending on where that wet water went, a significant increase in employment in the basin, particularly with the open trade of water, depending on where that water sourced from. But you would expect some major differences and major impacts, particularly in the northern basin, in terms of that loss of water and a loss of employment in those areas. So at a national scale, the picture might look good if the water was traded to the extent possible, and of course there are barriers to that, I understand that, and very complex trading scenario as the Productivity Commission shows, and the disconnection of the basins, etc., etc. But there would be quite significant differences. But in terms of how communities have reacted to different scales, as I'll talk about in a minute, these impacts would very much be mediated by the indicators of well-being and resilience that they experience now, and other mitigating factors like ability to trade, next best use, access to alternatives, economic activities and so on. So moving through to strategy two, and again it's a real, it's a big study, so I'm just going to try and give you a very quick, because I want to leave 5 minutes at the end, if I can, yeah, that would be cool. So basically this is about the climate change policy change, that is, reduced water. So we've forecasted, you know, hypothesised, if you like, a range of different scenarios, 10%, 25%, 50% reduction in water availability, modelled that. They looked at change in agricultural use and changes in community wellbeing and so on. The first question we asked is, do increasing levels of employment in cotton, which is what we were asked to do, lead to a more positive indicator of wellbeing or resilience? And we did this via quite a significant piece of desktop research. Not a lot of change in terms of if you move to cotton per se as a use. Wellbeing indicated very slight impacts on chronic ill health and premature death, a slight increase in those. In terms of positive indicators, a very slight improvement in increased employment. In fact, in terms of job losses that have been seen between 2001 and 2006, that I'll talk about in a minute, Those employment decreases were only one third for cotton compared with other agriculture, like general agriculture. So it's actually is doing quite well. A younger population of workforce, that's what our correlations would show, a higher skills base and lower youth unemployment. So that's, I'm not going to go into great detail, but overall, interestingly, there are some positive impacts one would expect from increases in cotton production. So there's some associations there that are, when we've controlled for a whole range of other factors known to be important, like remoteness, indigenous populations, urbanisation, etc., is controlled for those factors through various proxy indicators. Interestingly, there's some quite good results there. Second question was, if the availability of water and therefore the mix of agriculture were to change, would there be a change in the indicators of well-being, things like employment, health, all those types of things I put up before in those inner circles? Basically, no. Most indicators of well-being and resilience are not sensitive to industry and especially agricultural mix. So, you know, think claims about different types of things. In fact, veggie production for some reason is associated with a somewhat more educated workforce. There's a few other things happening there. Overall, it's not about agricultural mix, but very importantly, the main impact from a change, for example, to dryland cropping or grazing, next best uses, would be major drops in total employment. And they're very differently distributed. So the flow-ons from those, when we model that with the socioeconomic indicators, in those inner circles, the 20 indicators, we would predict a loss of population, that's a bit of a no-brainer, an older population, older workforce, an increased concentration of disadvantage, an increased concentration of Aboriginal people, but the disadvantage is independent of Aboriginal people, and obviously the impacts upon services and diversity as a more qualitative aspect. And so basically there are marked impacts depending on the context. So obviously, as I said, employment multipliers are most significant in smaller and more remote communities. One would expect a significant contraction in the local economy, and I won't talk about that too much now, but it's in our report. So what are the key determinants of community wellbeing over and above the sorts of things that we're looking at in terms of the water policy? So isolating those is important. And we've got a bit of confidence in terms of the modelling we did in the 303 statistical local areas in the basin, linear regression analysis. Key things supported by the literature, but there's other things too, which is, I think, Professor Martin talked about. Remoteness, absolutely crucial in terms of wellbeing. The more remote, the lower the educational participation, the more it's losing population, those types of things. So very significant thing to isolate in terms of a study on this area. Degree of urbanisation, so things like size, proximity to a larger centre, the presence of an Indigenous population, particularly a remote Indigenous population, the indicators go right up, isolating for everything else or controlling. Degree of economic diversity is certainly still a key factor. It's not as key as some of these other things, but and also it's a bit of chicken and egg, because the areas that are closer to the mineral resources and closer to the large centres obviously have greater economic diversity. And there's, you know, tension about how much a community can pull itself up by its bootstraps around those types of initiatives, clearly. Natural attributes are a big one. Amenity, environmental factors, those types of things that influence the tree change and sea change populations, which are accounting for most of the in-migration in many of the areas where there is a population increase. It's generally in the smaller, more remote areas, or not remote, but the smaller areas, it's generally because they're attractive. Also because they may have Indigenous populations with much younger populations, so there's a natural increase there. The case studies support the importance of more qualitative factors like leadership and social capital, and I've written a lot about those in the work we're writing up now. And it's also more complex than just this desktop analysis when you start looking at the policies in relation to other areas, small areas. So now I'm going to talk about some of those impacts at the basin and the small area level. So in terms of the quantification of impact, as I say, we're doing a cost-benefit analysis, which we've done a first cut on at the nation and basin-wide level, which shows some very significant impacts, just modelling a few key environmental assets that may be watered. We've also quantified employment and population loss from various sustainable diversion limit scenarios. That's a 10, 25 and 50% cut, and related impacts on indicators of wellbeing and resilience, which I'll talk about in a minute. We also know qualitative and locational factors are very important. Previous adaptation to change is critical, so understanding that helps us to understand how these communities and others may adapt in the future. We try to document that as best we can through extensive interviews and so on of what's happened in the last few years, last 20 years. Mitigative factors, the ability to trade water, the next best use, and other factors. So when you put all of those things together, you start to try and understand the social impact. So we've done the quantitative work, but it's very much qualified by what we're seeing in the local communities. And before I go on, one could say that the recent changes in water availability through drought and also trade out of area in some of the communities we've been into, one could see the real-time simulation for reduced allocations in climate change. In many respects, I think it's a really interesting time to be studying these communities in terms of what a permanent loss of water might actually do. And also, as I say, understanding how our communities responded to stresses can help us to understand how others might respond. So looking at a few of these quickly, and I need to save 5 minutes, so let me know, is a remoteness average. So you can see that our case studies are Belong, which is the George area, Burke, Moree, Dalby Wombo, Campaspe, which is Yuchufa area, and Mwala, Griffith, Mildura, Murray Bridge. And you can see that there are some very remote areas, Burke particularly, Belong, and they're mainly in the Northern Basin, though Mildura is certainly more remote than the Murray-Darling Basin average, which you can see in the red. And you saw before, we looked at this because remoteness is an important one as far as predicting certain types of indicators of wellbeing and resilience and changes in them. You can see again, your Northern Basin is up there in your light blue. Burke's got 30% Indigenous people, and Belong 10%, Moree 20%. So you can see your basin in the southern areas don't have Indigenous people. You see the disadvantage is markedly different in most of your case study areas in the north. Very disadvantaged areas, quite two very disadvantaged areas. Murray Bridge is the standout in the south, but most of the other areas with the dark blue, the southern, plus the Dalby Wombo area in Queensland, which is much less remote, has good access to the coast and to large centres, good access to the extractive and energy industries, which of course are significant mitigating factors against the basin plan and other reductions in water. You can see there are issues there. So key factors that we, in terms of the regression analysis we've done, are again Indigenous population remoteness, and you can see them played out in the case study areas, no surprises there. But certain surprises in terms of Murray Bridge, because it's not remote, it's growing, all those sorts of things, but it's got a lot of cheap housing, big development of housing trust, social housing, 79, major agricultural profit, lots and lots of entry-level jobs, waves of disadvantaged migrants and refugees, big regional centre for areas that have got up to 68% agriculture and places that have been emptying out into that area of quite poor farmers over a couple of decades. Population change, kind of a scary one. So you can see that in our case study areas, those three, St George, Burke, Moree, losing a lot of population, 0106, very exposed to the drought. The upper areas, Wombo again, different because of its different location and its different economic base. Again, most of the southern basin ones similar, largely, as I'll show you in a minute, for various reasons. Initially, I thought before I went into the field, yes, it's all about, you know, the levels of amenity and it's about, you know, the tree change and so on. But we look at employment change, similar but greater. So employment change was greater in these, and as it has been, in fact, across many of the northern basin areas compared to the south during that very bad period of the early drought, 0106. So employment change is correlated positively with an Indigenous people because they're younger and having lots more kids, and with an increase in population. So that tends to lead employment rather than the other way. But that said, the key factors in population change are the industry sector, the remoteness, Indigenous population age, but also these issues of amenity. So I've talked about those. But it's a much more complex relationship. So as you probably know, in the southern basin, and this is probably one of the critical factors in terms of then modelling what might happen in the south with what's happened in the north, it has a highly regulated river system with major upstream storages, obviously in the Dartmouth and the Hume Dam, lots of systems of weirs and locks, the length of the river, the prescribed watercourse. It's been largely cushioned from the drought, 2006-07. In fact, most of the area's got 100% allocation during that period of time. But 2006-07 plummeted, historically never happened before in the Southern Basin history, most of the area, 60% allocations. 2007-08, 32%. And don't forget, these are high security areas of permanent plantings and permanent dairy herds. And 2008-09, it started at 2% for 5 months, 4 months, and then went to 18% for the River Murray prescribed water course. So a shock would be certainly the one would describe that for an area used to having 100% water allocations. Hence, a cushioning from the impacts of the Northern Basin. Northern Basin has experienced, of course, drought impacts from 01 at least. Historically, it's less protected and more exposed to climatic variation. It's not as regulated. You haven't had 100% water allocations through the beginning of the drought. You could draw some simple conclusions from that. For example, 20 years of structural adjustment in 3 years, or is it more complex? And I think the case study from below Loch One will tell you it's more complex. And you could draw another simple conclusion, the drought in real-time simulation for the SDLs and climate change, it's a simulation for what will happen. Again, more complex. Some areas are already losing population, probably will anyway, but certainly hastening the change has been a significant issue around this. There are wider forces at work, I won't talk about that. I'm going to put up a quick quantification of local impact. So this third study that will be out in about 4 weeks, hopefully, you'll see we've modelled. This is a 50% modelling of cuts in SDLs and climate change, so the two things together. So you're looking at even small job losses in Burke are major in a small economy. So because it's very agriculturally dependent, 8% job loss, 9% population loss if we cut 50% of the allocations through climate change and under the SDLs in the basin plan. Big impact on the indicators, a very residualised population. As the town clerk said, we need to tell the federal government that if this is what happens, we're going to need an intervention like the Northern Territory. So it's an interesting one up there, whether or not that's an exaggeration. But certainly significant residualisation would be forecast in that population. The long, again, big impact, a lot of reliance upon agriculture. Derby Wombo, much less so, that's what you'd expect to see, no impact on the indicators that we would forecast in our modelling. Moree, significant, but it's got a wider agricultural base, it's larger, but still more disadvantage would happen as a result of those cuts to SDLs, job losses and population loss. It's a vulnerable community that's sitting on the cusp of a particular population size that you think could be quite problematic for it in a significant reduction in water. I won't talk about that in detail, but Burke, big issues there. Griffiths, major cuts, depending on where it came from. It'll be lower if it's rice, because a lot of trading is happening out of rice at the moment into other uses, veggies and so on, and permanent plantings to keep them alive. So low rice can be grown, obviously, seasonally. But 90% job losses, 19%, 25% population loss. If it came out from right across the board, adverse impact. Capacity, 11% job, 13% population. Big hinterland processing reliant upon what's produced in its hinterland, and it's got a lot of irrigated agriculture. Mildura, 14%, 16% population loss. Big hinterland processing. Significant increase. Even though it's a big centre, it's exposed because of what its manufacturing base actually is. And Murray Bridge, not as much impact because it's got a significant hinterland of agriculture, but it's growing and it's very close to Adelaide and there's a lot of other things happening there. So that's the scale of the local government area. You can see in those 8 case study areas, for various reasons, you'd forecast quite big impacts to major impacts with some mitigations that we've tried to understand through the case study. Now we drill down, which we've done in the north and the south, to a small community in each of the big communities. The case study below Loch One, I have to say there are no winners. If you know where Loch One is, it's Blanchetown, and it's the area which is regulated largely by the barrages at the mouth of the Murray across Lake Alexandrina. The lower lakes, when we were down there, certainly like areas up here too, there are environmental impacts and social impacts. The lower lakes and the Coorong are on life support there, I would say, as people said to me often, the farmers said, with a great deal of sorrow that they're on life support, that was their term, not mine, and they're at 0.7 metres below sea level currently, and there's fresh water being pumped 24 hours a day from Lake Alexandrina to Lake Albert to stop the acidification of the soils because of the exposure of acid sulphate soils. It needs about 2,000 to 3,000 gigalitres to bring them up to baseline and about 800 gigs a year to actually keep them as a freshwater ecology, just those lakes. And there are significant environmental benefits internationally and nationally, and social benefits in the Lower Murray. For example, all the dairy farmers around the Nerang Peninsula who rely upon those lakes, who have been having to drag out their windmill pumps now 500, 600 metres into the cracks in the lake. So it's a nightmare, to put it mildly. And offset by, however, the potential loss for just those 800 gigalitres, not the 2,000, but the 800 gigalitres to those lakes, which need the water, by potentially 1,000, more probably 3,600 to 26,500 jobs to actually offset, to actually provide 800 gigalitres a year of water to water the lakes. So it's massive impact to water those lakes as valuable assets. Obvious practicalities regarding where they get the water from, it's going to be largely from the southern basin, so it's going to be probably at the higher end depending on the trading and so on, and there's lots of things that happen. But the lower estimate is akin to shutting down a town the size of Yass, and the upper estimate is akin to shutting down three towns the size of Albury. So Murray Bridge is likely to be resilient, as you saw, because of its size, proximity, growth, etc. But the communities, especially the small ones, are also what they've described as being on life support. That's in the last 3 years, particularly through low allocations, and you've seen them, low river levels and groundwater depletion, and this last year a real hit in Chardonnay and commodities prices generally, and dairy as well. Very high levels of recent debt from buying in water to supplement the allocations. Not having been able to sell their water have been big issues. Buying in feed is a big issue. Lots of debt. And many inefficient operators were shaken out in the last 2 decades because there's been an extensive process of modernisation in South Australia. So a lot of the ones who are leaving now, as the CNAs are saying, are the good operators. That said, South Australia is still a net importer of water. It's importing 300 gigalitres last year compared to an outflow of 3 gigalitres. So it's high value uses. People are paying a lot to buy it. Mypalonga is our little case study in Murray Bridge, and each of the LGAs up north has got one of these too. And population of 600, stable, even slight increase in recent years. So it's not dying by any means. It's a small community, but you know, a lovely community. Agricultural employment 30% at the moment, probably higher before off-farm. Production, fruit, vegetables, olives, grapes, irrigated dairy. But since 2007-08, it's lost 85% of its dairy production, 20% of fruit and 50% of its vegetables. And if I could just read you very briefly from the case study. So this is one of the things that I have been working on most recently. This is the work from the field. And basically, in the words of First of the Drought Relief Worker, to give you a bit of a picture, because stats are pretty dry, aren't they, you know, and we all have a story. So the drought relief worker, who up until 6 months ago was running a very profitable dairy stud, or had been profitable, who's now turned the water, well, actually had to shut down and sold her entire herd. And she says of Mypalonga, where she lived, it was just the most beautiful place. The river makes an oasis in the middle of the dry lands. If you could have seen it, the most beautiful fruit and vegetables, olive trees and orchards sitting above the green dairy flats and the brown river below it. But now we're chopping down the trees, burning them in piles in the fields. The women come to talk to me. The thing they talk about is the smell of smoke all the time over our beautiful valley. And the vandalism of turning off the water and destroying what's taken 80 or 100 years to build up. There are men at the abattoir saying, why are they sending 2- and 3-year-old heifers here to be slaughtered? Milk dripping for the udders, saying, I can't do this. It's the most terrible waste. It's a crime. In terms of, she introduced me to a man called Max, who generously, like many people, gave me a full day of his time and introduced me to many growers, many communities, the school and so on. Max is a third generation Mypalonga fruit grower, and he generously showed us around his town. He showed us the oval that they're keeping green with the water they're buying in. Most of the town in Murray Bridge isn't, it's dry because they can't keep the water up to anything at the moment. The Mypalonga Traders, which is an 80-year-old co-op, which has been in danger of closing, but they're keeping it open through volunteers at the moment, and till the water comes back. And the school that they're keeping alive by busing in people from Murray Bridge, again, till the water comes back. In his words, we changed over, he's been in the production since 1901, his family built the house on the property where his father still lives. We changed from stone fruit to citrus and then to grapes a few years ago. You change as the market changes. We bought more land, they were one of the successful ones, and many of them are, the ones that are left are the successful ones generally in these areas. Planted the Chardonnay, the Shiraz, the Grenache. We had a contract with Orlando and they were the good times, but in 2009 the commodities price was very bad, projected to be so for 3 years. On top of all the water we had to buy in the last 2 years and the debt, I would have been working for nothing and I can't do it. My son was doing the books, he saw it was coming, he left before I had to say anything. I tried to some orders to the Commonwealth, but I put in a bit of an amber claim, a protest if you like. Then I tried to sell when things got really bad to South Australian Water, but they were offering less than what it was said to be worth and I hung in. Then I leased it to the Central Irrigation Trust, which supplies to Michael Longa. So South Australian Water didn't want to buy it then, and I'll have another go in round two of the buyback. Really, I don't know if I want to sell my permanent water, but I might end up losing more under the basin plan. They said that the Commonwealth might just now be able to take your water off you and not give you anything, so maybe I should try and sell it now. I just don't know what to do, it's all uncertain. Then he said, it breaks your heart to turn the water off. I'm a third generation father. My father still lives on the property in a house that was born on 50 metres from me. He's 93 and he's passionate about farming and the river. It's been his whole life. How can I just rip out everything he's worked for? I know it's not good business, but I'm still watering three rows of citrus and some stone fruit just to keep some greenery around Dad until he dies. He then took us to his cousin's place where the vine's still producing in abundance because he's decided not to turn the water off at this stage. He's taking on more debt, but he's really up to his eyeballs. We stopped now and again and Max picked us fruit like Grenache and others and tried to tell us the difference. I was having trouble tasting the difference, but there was an enormous, obviously, pride in what he was producing. And back at his own property, many of the fields are obviously dying and some of the fields are refusing to, although he turned the water off 6 months before. He said, land had bought up a contract, but some of these grapes are hardy, they're just not going to die. There's a drought-resistant variety. If they last through the winter, I might give them a bit of water. Maybe I'll bring in some or buy some, or maybe I'll grow some vegetables and we'll see. At the end of the day, Max took us to visit his father and it was a very sad thing for him. And he kept asking, you know, why has the city turned against the farmers? I don't understand it. And he said, tell Max to give me some dried fruit before you go. Take it back to the city and give it to the people and tell them what it used to taste like before we brought it in from overseas. And they gave me a big bag of it and it was great. So that's it. So I guess the last thing I would say is those images are evocative. The social, economic and environmental impacts are enormous and each of them have their own story and each are valid. And at the moment what we're really looking at, and I think the federal government has an enormously difficult job of optimising the trade-offs and how they're going to be developed, it will be enormously difficult. I think the best we can all try to do is to make the best available information available so that we can all make our decisions with our eyes open and also understand that sustainability means optimising social, economic and environmental trade-offs for the good of all, including with the communities who are most affected. Thank you.
Thanks, Judith. We had to pull her up because I would have had to have upped my medication if she kept going. But just a quick comment. It's not about trading, water trading. It's the fact that communities get traded off. And I think that's what stood out for me. And I'm conscious we've got people in exactly the same position sitting right here today that you just highlighted. We have got a 5 minute time lag. So does someone want to make a comment, given the cap restructuring that was announced last week on the Murray-Darling? That would reinforce that. Maybe Jeff Wise from Burke there, or Andy Lewis.
Thanks very much.
Massive disconnect. I think that what I find most interesting is that there is, and I think a lot of researchers have indicated this and writers, that in fact, whereas once we, I think people in the city, identified quite strongly with the bush and so on, I think there's been quite a strong shift in the way people are thinking, their connections, but also the discourse that accompanies that. And in fact, you know, farmers talk about this all the time, the feeling of blame, rather than a feeling that, that there was any support and acknowledgement for the value of rural communities. One of the things that startled me was talking with a group of bureaucrats off the record and in relation to a couple of departments who said basically that nobody wants to live out there anyway. There were people in departments that are making decisions and that basically many types of food shouldn't be grown in Australia. And they're extreme views, but they're not uncommon views among people who are voting, have a bulk of votes, which is in the city, and I think it's extremely difficult. And I think there is a very real challenge for rural communities in trying to be able to put across the same arguments with the same power as the environmental movement is, which is a very important movement. But somehow there's not the resonating factor at this stage in the press, in government, and certainly in urban communities. And I think there's a massive challenge. So why I'm telling stories as well as statistics in the work is because I think it's important to understand the views and the real experiences. I think we all have to do that.
Thank you. One more?
That she's published there, I believe, so far.